Hi, I am Takuma Sato. You're listening F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
You want to
keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 835, June 8th, 2020. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. It has taken 6 months, but we now have motor racing in our lifetime. Moi is very excited. How about you on the left coast, Mr. Host?
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, I really don't like IndyCar when they're at an oval. Porsche says, we're done with IMSA. We've got more from Gary Sloan and InThePitLane.com. This week's vintage interview, 2009, Jackie Oliver. And I want to remind all our listeners that we need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. Nas, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I am doing very good, sir. Thank you for asking. I have to ask you, what is your beef jerky with the IndyCar racing on an oval?
Yeah, it's not very exciting. When they're on a street course, I love it. It's exciting. It's machismo. But I know it's people like that excitement. I mean, I was happy for Scott Dixon. Don't get me wrong. I like Texas. I think it's exciting. Except that I just don't like ovals that much, Nas. I'm sorry.
Sir, you have to witness with your own eyes the Indy 500 or the IndyCar race at Fontana. Then you will be converted.
I will be converted. And after that, I will toss away Formula One and just do Martinsville.
Actually, that is not a bad idea. You'll have like 45 races in a season and you can enjoy that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Nasser.
Yes, sir. We have Slings and Arrows from Ralph Schumacher in the news. Remember the song, Jane's Getting Serious? Well, Ralph has now launched his own V2 rocket on Grove and Williams Grand Prix team. I'm sure you read about this. The younger brother of Phil Schumacher was a Williams driver, and all his 6 wins were under the dynamic leadership of Frank and Patrick Head. According to Ralph, putting the for-sale sign at Williams F1 team is proof positive of Williams family's poor management. He added this could be a good opportunity for an investor with deep pockets, but if Frank and Claire withdraw completely, which I think would be the requirement of any serious investor. One of these river deep, mountain high, Gashola people is the Russian businessman Dmitry Mazepin. If Ralph has his numbers verified by Arthur Anderson, then this comrade has more rubles than Mr. Latifi and Mr. Stroll, which is very, very impressive. They say good things come in three, so I look forward to 3 Trustafarians in Formula One, coming soon to a track near you, especially if you're living in Österreich Republic, also known as Austria. What say you on this situation with Ralph and Frank and Eau Claire?
Well, it's nice to hear from Ralph, you know, with his loving relationship with Frank and Patrick. And those were great days, you know. I remember Alex Zanardi. Damn, what a team, huh? Yes, indeed. But good old Half Schumacher rears his head. brought some good memories, but I think it's a bunch of nonsense, and he should really, I mean, go call Jacques Villeneuve or something.
But wait, there's more. This time from across the border in the Netherlands, team owner in GT4 racing, Mr. Frans Verschuur, would like Renault to drop Cyril Abitbol. He said, and I quote, "In my opinion, there are three of them in Formula One that have to go. Abitbol, Claire Williams, and Mattia Binotto. Abitbol is making a mess of it. He had two friends at the top, but they are both gone now. I think it will get too hot for him." Sounds like Franz may not be seen in Formula One paddock anytime soon. Sir, you're a big Renault man, and you have inside lines there. Are you happy with the job Cyril Abitbol has done?
No, I want to see him canned and shipped off to Siberia.
And who should be put in his place?
Flavio Briatore.
Oh, then Nando will come back for sure.
Bravo, prego.
Next item on the agenda, sir, is back to the front. Idea for reverse grid was floated to experiment with a 30-minute qualifying race on Saturday, result of which will determine Sunday's grid. This is something they do in some racing series and also at the Macau Grand Prix. And this was to be done in the second of the two races at the Red Bull Ring next month. According to Christian Horner, Toto was the only one who was not interested in this idea. Gee, I wonder why. Why would you want the fastest car and maybe the fastest driver on the grid start from the back? Nobody will like that. A revised version of this is still used in F2 and F3 these days, but only the top 8 positions are reversed. And this is how Mick Schumacher got his first and only F2 win last year. F2 is great, Mr. Rogers, but I do miss our favorite Happy Dos. Let me ask you a question. Do you have any interest in reverse grid?
Not in Formula One, but to be honest with you, because of the situation with COVID-19, the shortened season, the compressed way we have to do things at a single track, I think we should have experimented with it this season just for fun and laughs. I mean, it wouldn't have hurt the championship in any way whatsoever, so I think it's a missed opportunity.
You know, there have been a few races where when Alain Prost won his first Grand Prix on his home ground, Dijon-Prenois, what had happened, the race was stopped and restarted, and he won on aggregate time. So I was thinking, you know, maybe one race this season or two, what they can do is they can do a race on, one race in Austria, regular race. And the second race, they could do like a 30-minute sprint race and then reverse the grid, the full grid, not just the top 8, and combine the results of both the races to get the winner. I would be in favor of something like that.
Keep up the good work, Nasser.
But I don't want hocus-pocus stuff like running the race in stages, competition yellow, and, you know, stuff like that I'm really not a big fan of.
They do a lot of competition cautions on this side of the pond, which is very exciting. So we could consider a competition shoe.
You won't let go of the shoe, huh?
I love the shoe. Ask Danica.
Oh, yeah, me too. The Montreal shoe. I was watching that race, and I just could not believe that somebody would throw a shoe at while she's leading a race. But that's the way it goes.
Gary Sloan, here we go. Whoop!
Hello, listeners. My name's Gary Sloan, and this is this week's edition of In the Pit Lane. So the shock announcement came that the Williams team is effectively up for sale. Now, there's been much speculation about the wisdom of purchasing a Formula One team, but there are several potential bidders for Williams. The front runner may well be Michael Latif, the Canadian billionaire and father of newly signed driver Nicholas, who has loaned Williams the cash to survive at present through his Lotus Racing Company. Hot on his heels is Sylvie Adams, yes, another Canadian billionaire who finances Williams' new test driver Roy Nissany. But never to be discounted is Williams' old friend Toto Wolff. Toto's just purchased a 5% stake in the team, and this might be a precursor to a full bid with maybe a consortium behind him. Once purchased the team, he may install his wife Susie as team principal. Now she's cut her teeth in that role at the Formula E team Ventura Racing. Then we should never discount Lawrence Stroll. He may in fact wish to own two teams, aka Dietrich Maestrich style. Media reports suggest a possible buyer is the Russian billionaire Dmitry Mazepin, father of Formula 2 driver Nikita. Well, he could well be a bidder for Williams, as he and his Uriclem Chemicals company do have a history, as back in 2018, Mazepin made a bid for the Force India team, losing out, of course, to Lawrence Stroll. Mazepin was a disgruntled loser, openly criticising the bidding process, having allegedly never been contacted by the administrator over his bid. If Mazepin is successful, there is an issue of his son gaining a super licence to drive in Formula 1. But of course, he could sign Daniel Kvyaty. The media may have picked the wrong Russian billionaire. Step forward Rostam Tariko, founder of Russian Standard Vodka and Russian Standard Bank. He also has a history of unsuccessful bids, and in the past he's bid for both the Jordan and Minardi teams. He also had a brief foray with Eddie Irvine to launch a brand new team, but this never materialised. He in fact could be the Russian that has shown an interest. Then, just when you thought you'd it all figured out, another Russian billionaire comes into the frame. Joining the party is Boris Rotenberg, founder of the S&P Bank of Russia. Along with his brother Ardke, he co-owns the SGM Group. That's the largest construction company for gas pipelines and electrical power supply lines in Russia. He's also considered a close confidant of President Vladimir Putin. So why is his name in the frame? Well, ex-Williams driver Sergei Sirkotokin recently stated his mission is to put together a 2021 race deal. He said, "I'm more concerned than anyone on the question of return. There are chances and we are fighting. I still have a very good relationship with Williams and I do not hide that I would like to come back." Sirkotokin is managed by S&P Racing, the motorsport management company owned by, yes, you guessed, Rotenberg. So maybe Sirkotokin's had a late night call from Rotenberg about his forthcoming plans. Stranger things have happened, but remember, you heard it here first. Well, my name's Gary Sloan from In the Pit Lane. More details at inthepitlane.com. Until next week, stay safe and stay well.
Thanks, Gary. Keep up the good work.
Okay, sir. Next on the agenda, Bernie seeking buyer for his old friend. According to Mr. Ecclestone, owning a team is very expensive hobby. Dear old Frank had to work so hard to make sure the team competed, and now to see it disappear like that, it's not good. Unfortunately, the current management do not have the same status as Frank has. He could get things done. You know, now that they have officially, and of course being a public limited company, they have to do these things. Now they have put the for sale sign. I expect, I would say maybe by the end of July or early August, some sort of offer on the table that will, information will leak out or will be made public. And I think Claire and Frank's days are numbered at that team. What say you?
It's a nice thing for Bernie to step in and help. I sort of think that with the history around Williams, maybe the other teams should have a say to make sure that they don't fall into the ghetto.
Yeah, we shall see. Now a few words from Christian Horner. He was talking to David Coulthard on another podcast and said, "Sebastian's debriefs would take about 2 hours. We'd be half an hour, and he's just completed the formation lap and tested his drinks bottle. The detail he used to go into in recounting every stage of the race, every stage of the tire, it was way too much information for us to be even able to digest, but it was a useful exercise for him to go through, recounting what could have been done better." On the other hand, according to Mr. Horner, Mark Webber's debrief sessions took around 15 minutes to cover the entire race. And now a word about his current love child. As Max matures, the information coming from him gets deeper and deeper because his understanding of details such as the wind changed on lap 6 to 8 when I was approaching turn 4 and 5. Their ability to recount detail is phenomenal. It's no wonder why some drivers become world champions and some don't. Some are so detailed and well organized, they have their physio to do a pit down countdown. And that was Gispachev Zinger of the Die. Any thoughts, Mr. Rogers?
Yeah, Hungary, physio, headset, Dennis.
Yes, and I'm calling Max Mosley. That did it. You do know, I'm sure, that after about 10-15 minutes of threatening Ron Dennis with that statement, his manager came to apologize on behalf of Alonso, saying that he will not be calling Max Mosley, and Ron Dennis had to tell him, "I've already done that." That's the way it goes, sir, sometimes. Next, ghost races and ghost fees. The Spanish Grand Prix sans spectators will take place in mid-August in Barcelona, Montmeló to be precise. Circuit boss Joan told local media they are not paying any money to Liberty Media as they will have no revenue from phantom fans. He also stated they were willing to hold two races, but Chase did not want to carry the extra burden. And talking of no fans, have you heard this, that the people at the British Grand Prix are thinking of putting cardboard, of fans, cardboard photographs or cutaway of fans? What say you on that issue?
I heard that. They're going to put cardboard cutouts of famous people like Marilyn Monroe, Winston Churchill. It's going to look like the cover of a Rolling Stones record.
Like they're in the stand watching the Grand Prix?
Exactly. It's going to look like Exile on Main Street.
Wow, pretty impressive. Down in Mexico, south of the border, the race organizers are saying they plan to welcome race fans on November 1st. But if things don't get better by then, they will tell local race fans 50 ways to watch Grand Prix. Switch on the TV and set yourself free. Sir, I am very sadly mentally now prepared that I'm not sure if the US Grand Prix will go ahead or not. But I think even if it goes ahead, I think it's going to be no spectators. So there goes this year's opportunity to watch Formula One racing. But if they allow spectators in Mexico, then maybe I can go there. It's not too far from FLA. Now, let's take a look here. Getting ready for season opener. Action is started, as you know, this week. McLaren driver Lando Norris did some private testing in an F3 car at Silverstone last week and said, "Driving anything that you can push and go flat out is going to be a good feeling." You know, I have spoken to quite a few drivers who have competed against Junior Series against Lando Norris, and the common theme against him is that he is testing all the time, which is very true because his Pepito has done very well money-wise and he can afford to do these things. And, we'll see how it goes. Red Bull driver Alex Albon is also planning a run in an F3 car before the home Grand Prix that will open the long-awaited 2020 Formula One season next month. George Russell will also be doing some action this month. And Mercedes will be testing, and they can do these, you know what they call PR day testing, using a one-year-old car. So they are also, I think, testing at Silverstone this week. K-Mag is busy in karting circles in Denmark, and Pierre Gasly is taking advantage of karting in very sunny Dubai. And sir, talking of great racing series, Formula W, the all-ladies series that has been given the chop chop for 2020. And they were going to actually race in Austin this year, but sadly, it won't be happening this year.
Let me guess, their title sponsor is Hooters.
That's a very good idea, Mr. Rogers. Actually, it is this company, Rocket, or Rokit, that was also the sponsor, now dropped from Williams. But Hooters is a very good idea. Okay, now we have another doozy from Dr. Marco. Now, I was very surprised to read this. There are reports that Bill Gates will be at the season opener in Austria next month at the invitation of Red Bull owner Dietrich Mateschitz. When asked about this, Dr. Marco was his usual short and straight to the point, saying, "This is not my role." Okay, sir, you already mentioned that Scott Dixon won the race in Texas Motor Speedway, a Honda-powered car, so good for him. It marks the fourth win for Dixon in Texas, and listen to this, win number 47 of his career, which is very, very impressive. He has now tied AJ Foyt's record of 18 seasons with at least one IndyCar victory, extending his own consecutive years with a win record to 16. I think on the all-time list, he is number 3, just behind Foyt, who's leading Mario Andretti. So very impressive for this kid from New Zealand. And our favorite Sato San did not race after a hard crash in qualifying. Now we come to your favorite series, All Rise, Le NASCAR. The stock car race at Hotlanta Motor Speedway was won by Kevin Harvick from Bakersfield, California. And sir, this next item was reported a week or two ago. This is very heavy news, especially if it comes to RP in talk with Ferrari. Roger Penske has confirmed that he had held discussions with Scuderia Ferrari about coming to Indy in 2022, either as a manufacturer or as an engine supplier. And of course, Ferrari is looking to keep their people employed, keep the natives busy, with the big slash cut coming in the Formula One budget. You know, it will be great for IndyCar racing, for Ferrari, but I think Ferrari, from a business point of view, unless they can supply or willing to supply 5-6 teams, I think they're, for them, what will work more would be sports car racing. You know, can you imagine Ferrari winning Le Mans? Wow, big. They have not won that race since 1965. Which way you think they will go?
I don't know. That's a tough call, but this is a new world. It's a new changing world. They're talking about the new normal. I don't even know what the new normal means. But all I know is I've got to go outside every once in a while. And if I go outside, I got to put a mask on. I remember if you put a mask on, you got arrested. Or they called you Zorro. But now I got to put a mask on. I don't like it, but it is what it is. So the new normal tells me that Roger Penske, when he talks, he is the new E.F. Hutton.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, Ferrari could use a little whipping up and some new blood and something exciting. And I think this could happen. Ferrari sells almost all of their cars in the United States. It's perfect. It makes perfect sense. And you know what's so good about IndyCar? No Mr. Chase.
Well, you have a car with him now?
I do have a problem with him. I've got a lot of problems. You know what? All I know is this is a great idea, and I'm rooting and I'm tooting for Ferrari to come to America and do, of course, road courses only.
Yeah, you know, and they can also bring in another magical name that I would love to see here, and it has some history at Indy, is the Maserati name.
Bravo, prego, mille grazie. Yeah, Maserati this, Maserati that.
Okay, sir, now starting this month, we're going to do a sort of remembrance, memoriam, whatever you want to call it, and just remember a driver who lost his life in the wonderful sport we also enjoy. So this is called Lost in June, driver by the name of Pierce Courage. He was a good friend of Frank Williams and lost his life driving for Frank at the 1970 Dutch Grand Prix. Pierce Courage was born on May 26, 1942. He came from the family that started the Courage Brewery in 1787. And his, you know, forefathers came from France, hence the name Courage, which in English is courage. So that's the little background on the family name. He met Frank Williams when Frank was racing at Mallory Park in 1961. Pierce was married to Sally Curzon. Her father, Earl Ho, was winner of the 1931 Le Mans 24-hour race. But his own father was not interested in his son going racing, and actually it was his mother who told his, her husband, "You have to pay for my son's racing." So good to have a mama like that. Pierce made his Grand Prix debut in the 1966 German Grand Prix driving a Formula 2 Lotus. Back in the days, you could do these things at the 14-mile ring. In 1968, he drove a BRM for the Reg Parnell Racing, and his best finish was fourth at Monza. For the 1969 season, he joined forces with his friend and drove a Brabham for Mr. Frank Williams. This was his best season in Formula 1. He was 8th in the championship, scoring 2 second-place finishes in Monte Carlo and Watkins Glen. For the 1970 season, Frank decided to go with a De Tomaso chassis. Signor Alejandro De Tomaso was originally from Argentina, and his wife was an American lady. This was not a competitive car, unreliable and heavy. Magnesium was used in its chassis and suspension. On lap 23 of the Dutch Grand Prix, suspension on his car broke and crashed. A wheel came off and hit him on the helmet, which dislodged the helmet. The car then burst into an intense fire, which could not be put out. The trackside marshal buried the car and the deceased driver under sand while the race continued. The charred remains of Pierre's courage were recovered after the race was over. Now, these were the standards in those days. Sadly, only 3 years later, at the same track and around the same area, another British driver, Roger Williamson, was trapped in his burning car and also lost his life. Today, there is a memorial to both drivers at Sanford. And, talking of this young kid, Roger Williamson, he was the first fatality that I experienced after I started following Formula One, and that's, of course, 1973. So that was a little brief remembrance of the unfortunate accident to Pierce Courage. And I'm not promoting this, but it's part of history and it's out there in public domain. It can be seen on YouTube.
Very good, Nas. Keep up the good work. An outstanding job, of course. And now we have the vintage interview, 2009, Jackie Oliver, Nasser.
Yes, sir, and this interview was very interesting, Mr. Brazier, on an evening, late evening, maybe early evening or mid-evening, took me to his, he runs a storage business in not too far from Mr. Brazier's palatial residence, and there was a USFNG-sponsored Arrows, and there was another Arrows there, and so we were looking outside. The night watchman saw us and allowed us in. And so we spent some time there, and I asked him if Jackie Oliver comes here. He says, "You can come in the morning and ask the secretary." And he told me the secretary has been with them for like 25 plus years. So next morning, Mr. Brazier and I showed up there, and there was Jackie Oliver. And I will never forget, I was hoping to get a 10, 15 minute interview. So I asked him, "Would you have some time for an interview?" So he looks at his watch. It was like 9:20 or 10. I think it was like 9:20. And he said, "Well, I have a meeting at 10 o'clock. So you have 40 minutes. And the best part was, we go into his race team office and he asked me to sit in the captain's chair where he told me he used to sit when he would do the team's meetings. So many thanks to Mr. Brazier and of course to Mr. Jackie Oliver. And I hope our family members, F1 Weekly familiar members, enjoy this conversation.
And now, this week's special interview, Nasser. Please introduce this fine gentleman and team owner.
Thank you, sir. This is with Jackie Oliver. And people like Jackie Oliver make motor racing such a fascinating sport. He was born in Essex, England on August 14, 1942. And his racing career started in 1961 at the Villa Flaminia. After driving for Lotus in Formula 2, he replaced Jim Clark as teammate to Graham Hill in 1968 after the Hockenheim tragedy.
Oliver qualified on the front row of his home Grand Prix at Silverstone and was leading when the car broke down. In 1969, driving the beautiful John Wire Golf-sponsored GT40, he won the Le Mans 24-hour race and the Sebring 12 hours. In 1971, he won the Daytona 24 hours in a Porsche, which he shared with the Mexican driver Pedro Rodriguez. In 1974, he won the Can-Am Championship, driving for Don Nichols' shadow team. He would drive in Formula One for the same team and later became involved in management of the shadow team. At the end of 1977, Oliver left Shadow and started his own Formula One team called Arrows. Some of his drivers have included Riccardo Patrese, Gerhard Berger, and Eddie Cheever, and team also had sponsors as varied as USFNG, Ranio Ceramiche, and Warsteiner. This conversation took place last month at his business, Arrows Self Storage Limited, which is based in Bletchley, Milton Keynes, same place where the Formula One team was based, and we did this interview in his team meeting room. My sincere thanks to Mr. Oliver for his time and to Mr. Peter Brazier for making this possible. Thank you.
Okay, I'm here in England with Jackie Oliver, Grand Prix race driver, team owner, and Le Mans winner. Mr. Oliver, how are you today?
Very well. Nice to see you. Nice to talk to your group through your podcast from California.
A pleasure and honor here. Before we talk about your great involvement in motor racing, can I get your thoughts on the Britain's newest world champion and the manner which it was achieved last lap thrill in Brazil?
Well, I mean, I know Ron Dennis very well because we shoot together, and of course we were colleagues together when he was with McLaren and I was with Arrows. So we still see each other on a social basis, and of course we were colleagues together in racing for many years with the Arrows team and the McLaren team. So I still see him, and the last time I saw him was a few weeks after that last lap attempt. So I have two stories. I have the story from his chief engineer, which I also see, who's now gone to NASCAR, Steve Hallam. And I got his view of what it was like on the last lap. And then a few days afterwards, I had Ron's view of what it was like on the last few laps. And it was all to do with the rain. And of course, Formula One teams now are even more sophisticated than the days that I was involved in them. And they have a man for everything. Right? And they've got a man that looks at the weather forecast. And the weather forecast comes as a weather map on the screen back in the garage, in different colours, where it's coming from and its intensity. And it's reasonably accurate. The closer you get to the event, like 10, 15 minutes, the more accurate it is if you're doing it hours before. They knew it was going to rain, they knew where it was going to come in from, and there was a prediction within minutes of its intensity. The trouble is, the intensity was a little bit late in coming. And as the story goes, Ron was on the microphone to the weatherman saying, "Where is this effing rain? You promised it to me two laps ago." Well, it did come. It turned from green, which was very mild, to a little bit more purple, but only on the last lap. And of course, the whole world saw the result of that slight delay in the predictions about the weather, but it came in enough time, and we have a British World Championship because of it. But I can imagine, from the conversations I've had with all my friends at McLaren, the intensity of the discussion about it on that last lap to be fifth. The interesting analysis of that is of course, that Lewis was not given a free rein to run the race himself. He was told what you've got to do is come fifth. And in sport, planning to come fifth, there's always the unpredictable that can cause the problem. The difference between McLaren and Ferrari on that last race was that Massa had to win. So he went out to win, and he did win. McLaren told Lewis to go out there and come fifth, and he did, but only just.
Barely. Now, Britain has produced more world champions than any other nation. Why is there such a strong passion for motor racing here? I'll give you an example. I was at the very first A1GP race, September 2005, a brand new series, basically after the season was over. 60,000 people showed up, and I was with a friend of mine from New York. He also could not believe how full the parking lot was. What is the reason why British people are so passionate about motor racing?
Well, the history goes back. It's a traditional thing here. If you take the English sort of invented most things. The Scots invented golf, but they don't have the best golfers. The Hooray Henrys in the late 1800s decided they want to ski down a mountain in Switzerland, but we don't have any successful skiers. The reason why we have successful drivers is because the industry, after the Second World War, here developed. They had lots of airfields that the RAF had abandoned in the 50s, and they were ideal to turn into racetracks. Right? Not all of them, but most of them. The English decided that what they should do is they should race on those old airfields, and as a result of racing on them, they wanted to make their cars quicker. So an industry built up of tuning, right? And tuning turned into development, right? Development turned into production of racing cars. So, I mean, if you want a successful racing car now, right? Especially during the 80s, the only place to come was the UK. So not only did you develop an industry, you developed a whole group of drivers that were driving race cars through the 50s, 60s and the 70s. Right? And that still applies today. So you end up by producing a lot of young people that are capable with their skills. And as a result, they get hired by the top teams, a lot also which are British, right? Or British-based. Right? So it's not the wit of man that you're going to produce more champions. Right? Interestingly enough, Brazil has produced a huge amount of champions, and they don't come from that era. So why are a lot of Brazilian drivers that are very good drivers? Is it to do with temperament? Interestingly enough, a lot of the young British Brazilian drivers that think that they can drive racing cars, you know, end up coming here, right, in doing Formula 3 or Formula Junior or A1GP. So they come to this country in which to hone their skills, and as a result get hired, as Massa did with Ferrari.
You mentioned you have a lot of friends at McLaren, and you're friends with Ron Dennis. You know, I know if I talk to Ron for legal reasons or for whatever, he may not be able to give me the answer. Let's see what I can get from you. You know, when they had this problem with Alonso, first I'd like to get your take on that. One thing I'm always curious is, it's been reported many, many times that in Hungary, he threatened Ron Dennis that if you don't slow down Lewis Hamilton, I'll go and spill the beans to FIA. Can you comment on these two things, please?
Well, racing drivers are very competitive individuals. And the best ones are the ones that are extremely competitive, right, and will take their competitive advantage further than perhaps they should do. Right? So if you want a successful driver, right, as Alonso is, you've got to expect that sort of treatment. Right? It's how you handle them is probably the key thing. Alonso was too aggressive in his approach, and tried to keep his closest competitor in Lewis Hamilton, right, down. Right? So perhaps he reaped that harvest by doing that. And maybe the handling of the whole affair, right, in retrospect, could have been different and kept that very good union together. If there was a little bit more give and take by both Alonso and by the team, maybe Alonso and Hamilton would still be driving for McLaren. And what a fantastic combination it would create. But human nature being what it is, it didn't. It erupted. Right? And there was a lot of animosity. And once you get to that stage, then there has to be a parting of the way, because it would damage the team and its progress too much.
Going back to your racing career, what was your first connection to motor racing? Was there any racing in the family? How did you catch the motor racing bug?
My father had a passion for what is now termed as supercars. In the 50s, he used to buy Mercedes 300 SLs, Maseratis, Ferraris. They were always in the garage. He was always changing them. And, of course, as a very young boy, I used to drive with him in the car. In fact, even before I was 16, I used to take the cars out of the garage at night when he was asleep and meet my older friends on an arterial road in Southend in Essex, just north of London, and drive them before I was even old enough to. I always thought he never knew. I never crashed them, so he never found out. But I suspect he did know and was waiting for the phone call. So, I mean, if you start off like that in the 50s doing those things, it's natural that a father that had got four daughters, all older than me, what he wanted a son for. It turned out that his son ended up as a race driver when perhaps he wanted his son to be a race driver and take over the family business. But, of course, once you introduce a young person to motorsport, then the business doesn't seem such an exciting activity to undertake. Fortunately, the business of racing did. It could easily have not have done, but it did.
So what was your first real introduction to motor racing where you said, okay, I want to be a racing driver?
My father bought me a racing car when I was 17. We made one. It wasn't very good. So I said, how about a Marcus? A lot of club racing in the early 60s in England. So the little Marcus was a sports car. That led on to something being better. So I said, well, look, we've been quite successful with the Marcus. What about a Lotus Elan? And the Lotus were producing road versions hotted up for racing called a 26R Lotus Elan. I took it to Crystal Palace and I beat the works team. When you start to do that, the works team look at its competitors and they say, well, perhaps we should have this young guy driving our works car, right? Because he's quick. Let's give him a contract, right? Because we want to sell more 26Rs to the punters. So if we've got a quick young English driver, it's going to stimulate that market. And as a consequence, of course, I had a contract with Lotus. Driving their Formula 3 car, driving their Lotus Cortina when Jimmy Clark wasn't available, driving their Formula 2 car. And when Jimmy Clark had that tragic accident in the works Formula 2 Lotus at Hockenheim, I was effectively the third driver of Team Lotus, so they stuck me in the Formula 1 car.
Quite a few drivers did not go to Lotus, and I was talking to Tony Brooks yesterday, and he also cited the, how many crashes Lotus cars would have. Did you have any concern about that? And, of course, motor racing was very dangerous in those days. And how did you find Colin Chapman in your dealings with him?
Well, I didn't deal with Colin Chapman until I came into the Formula One team. I dealt with all the engineers that were there, and, of course, they were a great supporter of me. But it was Colin that would make the decisions. The opportunity to drive the Formula One team was not the best opportunity for me because it was jumping in the deep end with Colin Chapman as the team leader that had just lost his best driver and his best friend. So there wasn't the sort of help that McLaren were giving to Lewis Hamilton in all areas. It was, lad, you're now driving a Formula One car, and the only most important thing in motorsport is Formula One. Here's the car, get on with it. The first race I did with him was at Monte Carlo. I'd qualified mid-grid at a very difficult circuit that I'd never been to before. I'm sitting on the grid. The only bit of advice I got was Colin sticking his head in the cockpit a minute or so before the start and said, lad, in the whole history of Grand Prix racing at Monte Carlo then, never more than six cars have finished this race. So you get your first world's limited point. Off you go. Right. not the sort of thing that's going to have much impression on me. You know? The words go in one ear and out the other when you're in the cockpit just before the start of your first Formula One race. Consequently, I hit Bouge McLaren and Scafiotti coming out of the tunnel on the first lap, because they'd collided and blocked the track. There was nowhere to go. It was either the rock face on one side or the harbour on the other, because I had no Armco during those days. I chose the rock face to squeeze through, took all the wheels off, and walked back to the pits and got fired by Colin Chapman. Fortunately, Jim Enderwright, the team manager, said, look, he's a good lad. We don't think it was really his fault. Give him another chance. So I got my ass back in the car again for the Belgian Grand Prix and finished fifth. But it was a roller coaster with Colin during that period. It was a university of motorsport. I mean, I drove everything for Colin. And that led me on to signing a contract with BRM for the 1969 season. So, I mean, it was my leg up. But it was a difficult baptism of fire for a young driver. Not the sort of opportunity that young drivers, they get a test contract with the team, they get ingratiated into the team, they get to know the car, they get a lot of psychological help, a lot of media attention, coaching, etc., etc. In the days that I started, it was, here's your crash helmet, no seat belts, there's the car, off you go.
Talking of young drivers, do you think it was easier for a 15-year-old who was talented in your age to get into racing, or this day and age where everything is so commercialized and managers are hanging around at go-kart tracks?
It was easier because there were less competition. You know, because of my father's help, I was one of very few drivers that were driving lots of cars during the late 50s and early 60s. So when an opportunity comes along with someone that hasn't had that 3 or 4 years grounding, then, you know, you might have a bit of talent, but also you've got a lot of familiarisation. Now, you've got 500 young guys that have been driving go-karts since they were 7. So the competition's much greater to get very few opportunities. There are not a lot more opportunities now in Formula One, even though you've got 18, 19 races, than there were in the 50s or the 60s.
Pretty true.
So I've got something organised for a Lotus Exige experience at Silverstone.
Shall we continue, sir?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, in your driving career, what was the biggest achievement for you or moments that you're most proud of?
That's a very difficult question because I was very successful in sports cars. Won a lot of races with Pedro Rodriguez and with Jackie Ickx. The trouble with sports car racing then, it was not a great demonstration of a driver's ability because the cars were fragile, so you always had to drive them with a little off the pace so that they would last the distance, whether it was a 12 hours of Sebring, 24 hours of Le Mans that I won, or 1,000 k's of Spa. You know, you had to be a little sympathetic with the equipment. And then it wasn't a driver's championship, it was a manufacturer's championship. So, apart from having to share with the driver, some who you got on with, some who you didn't, I got on very well with Pedro Rodriguez. He was a great teammate. We enjoyed each other's company. And we were driving together with BRM as well. So it was, although it was my most successful in terms of victories, it was not something that I found particularly satisfying for those reasons. Formula One kept on finishing third, led a few races, cars kept on breaking. But I never won any Grand Prix. So that was an opportunity missed. There's always reasons why. I tend to look back and think I was unlucky, like at the British Grand Prix I led, because it's a circuit I knew under that difficult period with Colin Chapman. But again, the car broke, led many races with BRM, because it was a fragile car. But I think looking back at all my Formula One career, I don't think I was really good enough to be a world champion. I think I was good enough to have won the odd race when things were going my way. I knew the circuit, or that all my biorhythms were together on that day so that I could put a performance in with a good car. So I think probably the race that was most satisfying was with the Formula 2 Lotus. Although I finished second, I should have won that race. And also the Formula 5000 series that I did in the United States, where there was Andretti and the Anser brothers. I did it for three seasons. I never won any races there and kept on finishing third in the championship. But it was a hard-fought series, of which I think I drove quite well with the shadow team. So there's never any one race that comes out that was my best race. Probably Le Mans 24-hour, because if you look at Indy 500, Le Mans 24-hours, Formula One World Championship, they're all things that look very good in a book that you won. So I suppose from the media perspective, the Le Mans 24-hour. But of course it was shared with the Ford GT40 with Jackie X. So it's not something that you can say is the best race that Jackie Oliver did, because there were other factors involved in it.
Now, recently there was a story about you interviewing Motorsport magazine. And a couple of things from that story were very interesting, and I'd like to get your take on it. Le Mans victory, Henry Ford sent you a car present, and you were very thankful, and then later he sent you an invoice. Can you tell a little bit about that, please?
Oh, yes. I mean, Ford Motor Company produced a number of replicas of performance cars in their period, and the best one that they produced was the latest Ford GT. It was a limited production of 1,000 cars or 2,000 cars, I can't remember. And it was at the Festival of Speed at Goodwood when the car had gone into production. Ford Edsel came up and was introduced to me by Lord March and the then chairman of Ford Europe, Roger Putnam, who I knew very well, because Roger was a junior salesman at Lotus in the 60s when I was there, so we know each other from the period. And he said, Edsel, this is Jackie Oliver, won Le Mans in the GT40 in the iconic golf car, he should have one. And he said, I absolutely agree with you, right, let's put him on one of the first cars that come into the UK. So I thought, oh, terrific. I subsequently tried the prototype a year before and was very impressed with it. Did a video for Ford, did a number of interviews about the car, and sung its praises, because it was, as a sports car for the money, was as close as you get to a GT40, but it had a lot of comforts. It was very easy to drive, it had good power, had a fantastic gearbox. So all leading up to taking delivery of the first car. When I got the car, I got an invoice, which was a bit of a surprise. £128,000 worth. Pleased with the car, paid the invoice, kept it for 3 years, did 1,200 miles in 3 years in the car, because the wife had nowhere to put her big handbag. Great car. Not very useful. Couldn't get my golf clubs in it. But it was what I call a face-place car. Great car that would start up when you got in it, no matter how long it had been sitting in the garage. Never had any problems with it. Super performance. But it was a face-place car because it looked so great. And I sold it 6 months ago for less money than I paid for it.
At least you had fun. The other thing I read, please correct me if I'm wrong, when you were racing, team members and crew members, they gave you a nickname, Noddy. Yeah. What was the reason for that?
It's a habit that I had and started right from my early career, and I carried through all my racing career, that to get away from and to settle the nerves before the start of the race, I used to get my head down and have a little nap. And in my latter career, I used to be able to do it in the motorhome. But in my early career, I used to find a place in the back of the garage, sit down and close my eyes. And in club racing, the friends I had helping me with the car put a number plate on the car called Noddy, because I used to nod off to sleep before the start of the race.
You mentioned Shadow, Don Nichols. When was the first time you got in touch with him, and how was he as a person to deal with?
Well, Don got in touch with me. I was driving the Titanium Corporation of America's car in Can-Am, the TI-22, with Peter Bryant. And I was asked to drive the car. I drove it for them for two seasons. In the second season, Don came to me and said, would you drive the Shadow? I said, well, thank you very much, Don, but not that little wheeled car. I think your design team has gone about it the wrong way. It's not the solution. If you're going to build and race cars, you need to have an element of engineering from the United Kingdom, because that's where the industry is. And a relationship was born where I drove the car and he started to produce a car in a shop with some British mechanics and Peter Bryant, the designer. That relationship grew to getting Tony Southgate as a designer, and we eventually won the championship in Can-Am with a Tony Southgate design car built in the UK. And my love of Formula One, Don and I together got the backing from Universal Oil Products in which to produce a UOP Shadow in Formula One, which I drove the first one with George Former. Because I got involved in putting that package together with Don, I did less and less driving and more managing, which led on to other things with the Arrows team. Not with Don, as some, you know, partnerships sometimes that we had dissolved for one reason or another, and my partnership with Don dissolved at the end of 1977 because he wanted to run back to the States when we lost UOP. I wanted to stay here in the UK with the operation that we'd put together with Shadow. He didn't. He went back to the States, and I stayed here and called it Arrows.
UOP Shadow was a very famous association and, you know, program, just like the GT40 in sports car racing. Can you tell us a little bit how the UOP sponsorship came about, please?
Well, when Don asked me to drive with that little wheeled car, I said, well, you're not only going about it the wrong way from a technical point of view, you're also going about it the wrong way from a financial point of view. My background is getting a technical department to build the cars with UK expertise and then finding the money through sponsorship in which to pay for it. So I said, what we should do is, you've got an American team, to try and find an American sponsor to back this. And I've got some experience of it, not a lot, but what we ought to do is to go out there in the marketplace together and propose such a program. We did. We found UOP on the umbrella of UOP saying that lead-free fuel is not dangerous to your car. There's no need to put lead in fuel. It was a program that UOP liked because they could prove that a racing engine could run on lead-free fuel, so therefore it must be safe for your road engine. And they bought the program. And they not only bought it in the United States, but for Formula One, they rolled out that marketing campaign through to Formula One. So that's how it came about. It came about with Don not spending his own money on racing, but what he'd started with his own funds to be augmented in the manner that I just described.
Now, at this time when you were partners with him running the team, who would make decisions on drivers?
Alan Rees and myself. I got a team manager in which to run the program here. I knew Alan as a driver, and I knew him as a driver and a team manager with the Winkelmann team, with Jochen Rindt in Formula 2. And he ran a very good operation, a very professional operation. So I said, Alan, would you be team manager for the shadow team? And he said, yes, I would. And helped me set up a facility here in the UK in which to design and build the cars. And he said he would. And that partnership endured with us together in Arrows for some 22 years.
How are we doing on time?
We've got about 5 minutes.
Okay. What was the reason, main reason, and again, I'm speaking as a racing fan who get information from the media, and who and when it was decided that you folks will leave, you, Tony Southgate, Shadow, and go to Arrows, form Arrows?
Well, what happened was is that I wanted in... The thing is, with whenever a business or an individual's in financial stress, they tend to run home. With Loshi OP, I'd found some other sponsors in Europe to help with the Formula One team, but Don wanted to hive down back to the United States. I wanted to hive down and back to the UK. So there was a split in the difference. Right? So I left the organisation and said, I think that's a mistake. I think we should produce cars for whatever series we're going to do, Formula One particularly, here in the UK, and close the operation down in the United States. It's not something that Don wanted to do for all the obvious national reasons. So we parted company. I bought a factory, right, hired the people from Shadow, which understandably really upset him. Right. I left quietly, and said to guys, I'm going to do it now. I'm going to do it here in the UK. Do you want to come and work for me? So, quite aggressive, but not unusual. And of course, it upset Don particularly. He thought it was disloyal and started legal action in which to try and stop me from doing it. He didn't succeed. He tried to carry on with Shadow, which... with the departure of so many employees, was a task that he succeeded, but not successfully with. And I went on to be reasonably successful with Arrows.
They say time heals everything. Have you ever been in touch with them? Do you folks talk now?
No. No, that was an acrimonious split, because I singly-minded decided that I wanted to carry on. Couldn't carry on with the Shadow name, which I would have liked to have done with Don, so I carried on my own with the Arrows name. And I think he felt that was inappropriate. He fought quite hard in the English courts in which to try to bring me down, nearly did. And I think if two partners that had quite a successful arrangement with Shadow together go through that sort of battle, then any friendship or good feeling is left as sediment at the bottom of the jar. So we don't send each other's Christmas cards anymore.
From the days at Arrows Formula One team, what were some of the high points? And you have this Warsteiner-sponsored car, which was leading the almost won the South African Grand Prix with Patrese. How was that feeling, and what other moments really that you're proud of?
We survived. My partner Alan Rees and I were different individuals. There was a good balance. It was a good partnership that still survives today. But I suspect that in concentrating on surviving in a very difficult industry, we managed to contest more Grand Prix than any other Formula One team has ever done and never won a Grand Prix. So obviously our survival skills were either muting the success that we could have achieved. Maybe there were moments when we should have risked more with what we had in our hands, and maybe we would have gone on to have been a successful team. We clearly didn't take those moments, and as a result we soldiered on as a mid-ranking field team for some 25 years. Interestingly enough, when I sold the team and left it to my partner then, Tom Walkinshaw, he took the bold approach, right, in which to make the team successful, which was, of course, for his demise. not only did the team go, but his bold approach took all his other supporting industries, which were in TWR, down with him as well. That could have been me, or it could have meant that I would have been successful and been like McLaren. You never know in life. I have no regrets. The team has a position in history in Formula One, which I'm reasonably proud of. I'm sorry that it's no longer on the grid, which perhaps it should have been.
And, you know, fans like me appreciate people like you who make motor racing and Formula One what it is. Finally, how about a message for F1 Weekly listeners, please?
Well, I think anybody that follows motorsport or participates in motorsport, the most important element of motorsport is its top echelon, and that is either NASCAR, Indy, or Formula One. Everything else is a pyramid that leads to that. So continue to support those two. The only admission to that, which I think is sad, is that there is no World Sports Car Championship. There used to be. It used to match Formula One in the 60s. But it's been decimated by the efforts of Eccleston and Moseley to the pinnacle of Formula One. I would have liked to have seen Eccleston have cultivated both a successful Formula One championship for drivers and a successful manufacturers championship for sports cars. I think that would have been a well-balanced world stage for professional motorsport, but I understand that in doing so, of course, he's going to divide the money equally between the two. Instead of that, you have a very rich sport in Formula One and a homegrown American sport which had two championships, which has caused its demise, which perhaps is the reasons why Eccleston has been successful with just one. As in all things, you have an idealistic view, but quite often the realistic view in compromise is the one that ends up succeeding.
Thank you very much, sir.
Jackie, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com one more time. And there you have it, Ness, another outstanding podcast for another outstanding audience out there.
Absolutely. Without the audience, this is going nowhere. And I would like to give a shout out to Lucien Byfield in Australia. He's been a very long dedicated listener of our show and recently sent me some kind words, and I greatly appreciate what he wrote and hope all is well in land down under for him and for all our listeners everywhere.
Nice job, Nass. And I'd like to throw it out there. I need some emails from listeners. Send me an email about what you think the 2020 season is going to be like. And I'll send you an F1 Weekly teacup. Blimey. So there you go, Nass.
Well, sir, good news is we are getting closer and closer to the start of the Grand Prix season.
It's going to be exciting. July 5th, I believe, July 3rd, whatever. Austria.
Lewis Hamilton all the way for you?
No, you know, some of us are going to go to the other side, to the good side, and that would be Leclerc.
Charles Leclerc.
Yep, he's going all the way, dude. He's going to take the championship and blow everybody out of the water. And not only that, he's going to take the championship and his Rubinho. Mamma mia, that's a spicy meatball. It's going to be very interesting. By the way, did you get a chance to watch the Triple Crown this weekend?
No, sir.
It was very exciting.
Well, that's good. It was Rubens Barrichello in the race.
Exactly. I was going to mention Rubinho.